Anyway, so I've got loads of these half written, half done things. So how are we doing, Harry? Are we on? Cool. So I finally managed to pin Mark down after possibly three years. I'm trying to get him to agree to either do an interview, a podcast, or something. A very reticent soul. I don't know why.
Well, I think what I love about advertising, and I realised this a long time ago, actually, that actually there's something glorious about being able to be very public in a very private way, because essentially, you know, you have the luxury of putting material out that is
speaking for you,
potent and strong, but it doesn't come necessarily with a signature, and it doesn't come with a
that's interesting
ownership. Yeah. And I like the anonymity of it. I think
I think that it's interesting that I'm not, but that I think that's true of a lot of people who are in creative departments, that they're quite either shy or not very forthcoming, but they sometimes create very powerful work. It's almost that's their outlet to talk. But yeah, I've not really considered that.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're an artist, then if you're an artist, you could say that, you know, especially if you think about gallery art currently, arguably the personality and the persona is as important as the work itself.
Hmm. So do you think that's changed?
Sometimes more important.
It seems so now that the persona of the artist is as important as the art now.
Yeah.
I don't know when that changed.
I don't know really. I think maybe...
I've got a friend who used to live with Anish Kapoor in the days when you would collect 2p's to use the phone. He said, and he would always have a massive bag of 2s and 10p's to talk to art critics on the red phone box on the corner, to put himself out there constantly. Yeah. But that seems, I don't know when the switch, perhaps it was always like that. Perhaps the old artists were equally showmen.
Yeah, I think possibly you have to be. I mean, certainly, you know, if you do the history of 20th century from Picasso to, you know,
But you look at Warhol. You see the tapes of Warhol. He looks horrified to be there, but obviously the stuff he put out couldn't be more disruptive and loud.
Yeah.
But as an individual, he always looks so uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, I think there've been a few shows that are actually sort of articulate. I mean, that have there was a show at the, and this is much about scale as it is about the nature of the voice. Was it the Tate about 10, 12 years ago? Was it Cruel and Tender? A huge exhibition of photography, you know, going through sort of 20th century. And at the beginning of the exhibition, there were massive photographs by, you know, Wolfgang Tillmans and the like.
Yeah.
Huge, great pictures. And by the time you walked to the end, you were down to imagery by Robert Frank and Joseph Sudek and Cartier-Bresson and all of that, and a lot of their work was small, and in a way, I felt their work didn't need to be bigger, and also didn't need to come with
the personality attached.
You didn't need to come with the personality, and you didn't need to know who had done it to understand that it was a powerful, striking image. And I think that sort of, and I think you know, a lot of what I've always made things, for instance, and I suppose for the last 20 years, I've found myself gravitating towards art objects or objects or things, artworks that are not made by artists.
Right.
So I have a great passion for Eskimo art, Inuit art,
right,
and for African art and for tribal.
And why is that? The humanity of it? The raw?
I think because maybe in those smaller societies, you don't have artists as such. There isn't the cult of the artist in the same way. What you have is individuals who make things.
I guess there's no commercialism, is there? It's direct from the individual.
But they make things for a purpose, and it doesn't matter whether it's a little votive sort of figure or a fish hook or a pair of decorated moccasins or a tribal... piece of woven fabric. There's obviously great artistry and great meaning and great cultural significance to those things, and full of artistic value and meaning and ideas. But ultimately, it's not important who made it. Really.
So, do you think you gravitate towards that because it's the exact opposite of the day job, where it is more commercial? That feels like art that's they've stripped away any sense of monetary value.
Yeah, I think possibly. But what is it we do? It's the question that one sort of asks oneself all the time. Oh God! What is design? What is it that we do? I mean, there's community. We're visual communicators. And I'm not certain that I've ever thought of myself as someone who's trying to sell things. I don't think that's my primary function. I think my function is to actually communicate a product. Put something
out. Present the argument.
To inform, to create a piece of information. I don't think it's necessarily my job to sell it, per se. And I think in making a piece of work, it can either be beautiful or ugly. You know, it can be bluntly coercive, or it can be. Enlightened and informative, and on the whole, I think it's a nicer place to be as a human being to create work that is both beautiful and to be enlightened and informative. So that I think those pieces of advertising that bludgeon you over the head, and obviously it works, but I don't think it's necessarily that good for the soul.
Does it still work, that bludgeoning business over the head?
There are brands out there that certainly throw money at very blunt and dull, use blunt and dull vehicles in order to actually make a point. That's like my current fascination, I suppose. And my current fascination is something that actually we don't talk about much, and that's feeling. But ultimately, what we're asking individuals or what we're asking the public to do is actually join us in a conversation to fall in love, with a product. And I think it's easier. I think mostly I would like to think that folk respond to a well-judged communication that has been cared for. I mean, that might be...
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's a bit like, that kid's story where the... is it the sun has a bet with the wind? Do you know that one?
Yeah.
About who can get the guy's coat off? Is that some sort of fable? I've got a vague memory of it. And the wind is obviously all powerful and is blowing everything over, blowing trees over, and the guy does his coat up and everything's flying everywhere. And then the sun gently gets hot and he takes his coat off. And it seems to me similar in that, there are certain people who try and do ads where they think we will bludgeon and beat this into people, but all their guard goes up and they just reject it because they don't really want to take that in. I mean, obviously you used to be able to do that a few years ago now, by the sheer weight of media, you just couldn't avoid it. But that's becoming less and less. You know, there are very few brands now that are totally dominant across all media. There's the odd one or two, but it's very difficult for anyone to do that now.
Yeah.
Now that media is less mass.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, if you think about, you know, I get up, you know, I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Before I get out of bed, I've probably looked at 1,000 pictures on my phone. By the time I got into work, I've probably looked at another 1,000 or websites, blogs, whatever, news. By the end of the day, I mean, how many things have you seen? How many things have you looked at? And yet we're meant to be the experts in what we should be doing is thinking
jumping
about
out of that
planting,
stuff.
Planting yeah. the one thing that you're going to, if I say to you, what have you remembered from today? What's the, if you could think of one image, one communication, one idea that has sort of landed? And yet we're beset, you know, we're beset at the moment with clients who just want content. And in a way, the content is 95% of it is absolutely will wash over you. You won't remember. Mm. It has little. And there's no staying power, and actually, so to find something that has been rendered with a bit more care, and consideration, and beauty, and thoughtfulness. You know, about what is, you know, I think was it Richard Seymour uses, what's his definition of design? I don't know whether this is, I mean, it makes life better. And I think ultimately, I think there's that's what you're trying to do, is you want to try and make something that actually has value over and above it merely being a notice for a pair of jeans or a packet of biscuits.
So I'd accept that as a good excuse why it's taken me 3 years to pin you down. So one thing I want to get to is, where were you brought up?
Where was I brought up? Well, yeah. I had I was born in England in Dorset, but my family. My father worked for an organisation called GCHQ, so we had an itinerant childhood. So I was brought up in places like Singapore and Cyprus. So I'm an outsider, really.
Is that how it affected you?
I've always felt like an outsider. I don't have
the new boy just turning up,
or just not comfortable with a lot of the sort of mores and customs of being British. So for me. My sense of home is not about cricket and about all of the other sort of trappings of what you would imagine to be British. And I think maybe, I don't know, I've often thought about whether it's given that the restlessness of being brought up in different places. And being more being open to more
experiencing new things must be,
you know, that it's given me a restlessness and a sort of curiosity, which I love, actually. I think that curiosity of always moving on and always sort of not being content necessarily with the thing that you feel comfortable with. So the idea, so at home, for instance, I've got very few pictures on the wall. The idea of actually having an image on the wall in a way freaks me out, because it feels like a massive commitment.
It's like a big statement to commit to one image.
Yeah. So leaning pictures, I think, is fine. Bringing pictures to the fore, having stuff around is fine. But actually,
nailing it to the wall.
Nailing it to the wall. I think as soon as you do that with something, it then becomes dead.
So is that because you were used to moving around and that feels too settled down and permanent? Or is that because there's so much stuff out there, you can't raise that one image beyond everything else?
I don't feel comfortable with words. I feel my world is a world of images and as a visual world, and I like the stimulation of seeing and finding new things.
Constantly new stuff.
Constantly new things, yeah. And there's nothing so exciting, you know, there's nothing so exciting as finding a new image maker, finding someone that you want to work with, finding a new... I mean, at the moment, I've got two photographers who I'm desperate to use, and I can't think of any projects that, at the moment that would allow me to use them. And and I want to use them before anybody else really uses them. But because I feel I know what I want to do with them. But so that has always been. I think that has always been there. But as well as, you know, I've always collected stuff. I've always drawn stuff. I've always made stuff. So there are lots of journeys that are involved with looking and making and renewing and moving on.
So did that start at college, or was that before that? When did you come back from Singapore?
I came back. Latterly, I was in Cyprus. So I came back to go to college. So I came back to England to go to college, and I went to Central, as it was before it was Central St Martins. And I must have been scattered. I mean, it must have been that curiosity must have been there. My external tutor for my degree was Alan Fletcher.
Oh, wow.
And all I remember from the conversation I had with him was, why don't you just do one thing? My degree show was...
He said that. It's surprising, because obviously he did a lot of stuff.
In retrospect, but my degree consisted of, I think there was some stained glass. There was some architectural lettering. There was drawn lettering. There was some explorations in, lots of other different media and illustration. And it was quite broad, basically. Yeah, I wouldn't say it was necessarily...
Focused.
That focused. But I think at that time at art college, I think I spent time in different departments, and it felt like it was the right time and place to be messing around and playing with different tools and doing different things. And I don't think necessarily, actually, I don't. It's always been in the back of my mind. Is what you're so schizophrenic. Why don't you just do one thing? So through my life, I have tried to find that one thing, actually, and been distracted along the way. I have found the one thing now. But it's taken, it's taken 40 years. It's taken 40 years
to settle down.
To find something that I feel encompasses everything that I want to say, you know.
But I guess then, when Alan Fletcher is saying that, people didn't do a bit of this and a bit of that, and they tended to stick in their lane, didn't they? You know, even advertising and design were like, God, trying to think, plumbing and tennis. I mean, they were just like, they didn't overlap very much.
Yeah.
They were very, very different things. Yeah. Now everybody seems to say they do both, and sometimes
I think they are, I think as disciplines, they actually are quite different. And I think that was the sort of, I remember Jeremy Sinclair when I was at Saatchi's, Jeremy Sinclair was the creative director. I remember being referred to as that designer fellow. In a very disparaging, tone of voice.
That would have been a real slap in the face back in those days. So how did you?
I've never understood that separation between. And one of my first agencies was an agency called Holmeside Ritchie, and it was a sort of quirky, sort of small agency that worked on all sorts of different projects, and we were designing identities, we were designing books, we were doing album covers and posters, we were doing ads, we were doing...
Unusual at the time.
And it was which was very unusual at the time. But that idea of, you know, if you're a creative, don't you want to invent the product, design the packaging, make the poster,
do the whole journey,
the poster, do the ad? Surely that's a more coherent way of approaching... a piece of a project. So I think that advertising, I mean, but obviously advertising agencies and design agencies or branding agencies have always sort of fought. There's always been a gulf between them, and I still think to a degree that that is still, there is still a sort of lack of appreciation of the skills that each of those areas sort of deploy. And I think it's much of advertising is about chaos. Much of advertising is about usurping convention, creating something that is sort of surprising. And on the other hand, I suppose what design is the opposite. So advertising can be quite short term, and a lot of people who are working in advertising are very short term thinkers. It's about
how do we arrest someone's attention right now?
Yeah, right now.
Yeah.
But actually, and I think in design generally, you're looking in the long term. You're creating structures. You're creating edifices. You're building castles. You know, I have to say, it's like, but if you're building a brand, you've got to build your castle before you start lobbing fireballs. So you have to understand and create a look and a feel, a spirit, a tonality, a world, before you start disrupting. And so agencies are traditionally disruptors, but not necessarily. They don't necessarily do or understand both, I don't think.
So what made you think from doing stained glass and lettering at St Martin's, what made you get into advertising? Particularly then, seems like the last thing you would want to get into.
I think they offered me, I didn't know much. I was sort of relatively naive. I didn't really know what was out there. I mean, obviously the world was a very different place in terms of being able to sort of test and see what was around. I think the first job interview I went, I did get a job within the first 3 or 4 weeks after leaving college. So I went straight from
college.
And
what would you have had in your book there? Your piece of stained glass, some hand lettering?
I had some sort of weird sort of three-dimensional illustrative something that was in between model making and illustration.
And you went for jobs with for jobs as an art director?
No, the first thing I went for was I don't know if you remember Shirt Sleeve Studios.
Yeah, Nancy Fuchs
and
Camden.
I think they for me summed up everything that I wanted. Already at that point they had a, I suppose they were more than model makers there. They created they were like three-dimensional graphic artists. And what they did I found really fascinating. And I remember going there and asking for a job, and there was none.
And how had you heard of them at that point?
Maybe they may have been into the college, I suppose. I don't recall, to be quite honest. I don't know how I heard of getting a job in an advertising agency, but it obviously.
And how did that go down? How did your stained glass and your models go down when you're turning up for? So you're going to jobs in ad agencies, presumably as an art director.
Yeah, but then,
with no ads.
But then obviously, this was, art. The idea of the art director was relatively new, and I suppose from the 50s and 60s, you still had artists on one side of the corridor and writers on the other. So, and artists were artists who.
So they wanted someone arty on one side.
Made posters. You had people who actually painted posters, didn't you? In the 40s and 50s, they were the actual practitioners who actually made. And I suppose this was the early 70s. I got a job as a trainee art director at Ogilvy, Benson and Mather for a salary of £1,750 a year.
Right. Who hired you there?
It was, I can remember the name of the creative directors. I can't remember the name. There was a person. There was it's almost personnel person, not a, you weren't hired by a.
Not a creative, it was sort of HR. Creative.
You were, hired by a,
And presumably someone must have taken you under their wing and explained how things went and what you were supposed to do.
Yes, there was an art director called David Burns Garside, but I did quickly notice that in the room next door, there was a writer called Salman Rushdie, who was, and over the road there was
Faye Weldon,
Eric Gill's granddaughter, right. Ruth Gill.
I've heard of Ruth Gill. I can't think why.
It was after Faye Weldon, but so there was a, it was quite eclectic, you know. Already then you sort of, you realised that actually that the that.
So what was a young Salman Rushdie like? He was a copywriter there, yeah.
Yeah, I believe, wasn't he working? I mean, his accounts. I mean, next room they worked on. They had the Woolwich Building Society, British Airways, and the National Dairy Council. Naughty but nice.
Is that what he worked on?
Yeah. Yeah.
And presumably, I would imagine O&M in those days was a bit like the civil service, wasn't it? Was that in Brettenham House?
Yes, it was in Brettenham House on the Strand, very formal. With the
public school.
The Savoy next door and extraordinarily formal. I didn't like it very much.
What did you work on? Did you get any work out at that point? What was your first work snuck through?
In retrospect, actually, the practice was actually quite good and quite interesting, because I think the first account I would have worked on would have been Smith's Crisps. And as a junior art director, the first job you were given was, you know, we want you to name a product, give you a rectangle, an image of a crisp packet, and within that space create a name, create an idea of a brand, create an identity, place those things, so invent a name, design a brand, logo, identity, place it with a logo and a descriptor. And in effect, it's sort of, you know, the last thing you would have been given is an ad to do, you know, that would have been much too important and too grand. So it was a sort of, but quite a good training in actually just, you know, dealing with a piece of type, an image.
So that literally would have been just training, not real briefs, just
No, they were, to they, train were you. They were real briefs, but you were called trainee,
right,
art director. You were not, you know, it was very much, within a group system, so within a group of four or five more senior people.
So was there anyone there that you either aspired to be or liked their work? Was there any glimmer of hope that you think, well, they seem to be doing good work? Or
no, not really. I think
it all seemed kind of gloomy.
It did feel very formal and very stultifying as an atmosphere, and obviously, you know, a year or two in, one was beginning to see, and I have an idea of what the world, the bigger world out there, and obviously at that time you had agencies like CDP and others who were producing work which was far more out there, far more creative, far more visually arresting, far more thrilling.
So what, and like what would have been around at the time that you were thinking, I wish I was doing that kind of stuff?
Fiat, you know,
CDP's Fiat.
CDP Fiat.
The sheep in wolf's clothing.
Exactly.
B&H?
Yeah. Would have been probably pretty early B&H.
The gold box rather than the surreal stuff.
Yeah. So it really became, you know, after about a year, it became a journey of, you know, one quickly realised that actually one had to find a way out. So I realised in saying that I've missed out an agency. Because the agency that...
So this is when we did your timeline. You've forgotten a whole agency.
I forgot a whole agency and I fled. I'd met a writer called Ian Dunn, who became my partner for quite a few years. We went to an agency, we fled, and the first agency that offered us a job was David Williams and Ketchum.
Did that become AAP Ketchum? Must have been. I guess it must have done.
I don't know much about them. Possibly within a month, we realised we'd made a.
So you left Ogilvy's to go there.
Yes.
That was what attracted you to David Williams' Ketchup?
They offered us a job.
Okay, good enough.
We could leave. We could leave. I think we.
And how long did you last?
I think we. I remember that. I mean, in my head, I think we. I feel that we resigned after a month. I can't.
Or in the, it's in good the, to give or, it the 4 months or, before you.
It wasn't very long. Basically, right. it was a very short stint. A couple of pieces of work. I remember doing a campaign that I quite liked. It was one of my clients was a plastic drain pipe and a pipe manufacturer called Key Terrain.
Right.
And I think I remember making ads where I created sort of sculptural objects from the bits of piping. So telephones and spaceships, and so I used the pipes themselves to actually make the stories. We had started showing our work around in that period.
So did you go to the more glamorous places at the time, like Collett's, and did you get interviews there?
No, we didn't go. We didn't go to Collett's, but we must have. Can I remember?
So the
first agency was Alex. The real break was in 1977. It would have been, I think, or thereabouts. I was getting a break, finding a man called Paul Arden. He was running an agency called LAP, the London Advertising Partnership, on Marylebone Lane, opposite Madame Tussauds, a small agency with about.
And did you find him, or did he find you?
He found us. He found us, and he remembered us. And I think he called us after a while. He remembered us, and I think he did. If I remember rightly, he remembered us for a campaign that we hadn't actually done. And he said, "Oh, you're the team that did the Mint Cracknell campaign, aren't you?" And we hadn't. And he said, "No. It's not us. It's not us." But anyway, he gave us the job.
Right. Funny.
And he
was creative director there.
And he was creative director. About 8 creatives, completely different atmosphere, an open plan office, which was very rare, which was very unusual at that time, where 7 or 8 of us all worked together.
And what was he like at that point? Was he?
He was crazy.
As crazy as he went on to be, or eccentric, not crazy, I suppose, or was he crazy?
He was eccentric. On one famous occasion, we won the McDonald's account. So LAP won the McDonald's account. So I was the first creative to work along with Ian on McDonald's in Britain. And I remember them saying at the time, "You realise that in 10 years' time there will be a store on every."
They said that then. I think the first one was in Woolwich, wasn't it?
Was it I've got Woolwich some, or Catford or somewhere.
It was Woolwich. Yeah.
We laughed uproariously at the idea that they had such a presumption.
These Americans with that, yeah.
Americans. Bob Ray, it was a big franchisee from the States called Bob Ray, was the client who set it up. Anyway, I think one of the key meetings early on, if I remember rightly, Paul arrived with green ears. And Danny Coleman, who ran the agency, wouldn't let him.
What do you mean he arrived with green ears? What does that mean? Well, I know what all the words mean. Paul, I just don't know what the sentence.
Obviously, in his latter years, Paul was, he'd taken on the persona of the sort of a senior client. He wore big, wide pinstripe suits, horn-rimmed glasses, and smoked cigars. He didn't earlier on. He was more a flamboyant dresser, taken to wearing kilts from time to time, wearing banana yellow suits. And I think he was early in taking on the idea of dyeing hair, but in those days you couldn't buy hair dye readily. It wasn't green hair dye, was not something you bought. And I think he'd use vegetable dye.
To dye his hair green?
To dye his hair green. You know, like a bit punk.
Wow.
Was that
in the punk era? I suppose it was just...
Yeah.
He wanted to dye his hair green.
Anyway, it didn't work.
But it took on his ears.
It took on his ears. And Danny Coleman wouldn't let him in the meeting. So obviously there was a strain of craziness, which was endearing and wonderful. I mean, he was a wonderful man.
So was that a craziness in that this would be good for my image, or was that just I feel like having green hair, so that's what I'm going to do? I mean, was it premeditated, or was it?
I think it was not premeditated. I think he was just a character who had no boundaries, and that was his, ultimately, that was his strength.
And what kind of work was done there? What work did he do or you do there at LAP?
Well, we already had the accounts that we carried over when LAP became Coleman. So it was accounts like Camping Gaz, which I won my first pencil on.
First ad in the you've ever got in the book was radio.
Yeah, it was radio.
Same as me. All good people get radio in first.
We had Citroen.
Yeah.
We had McDonald's. So they were significant pieces of business.
A very close
creative team, very creative atmosphere, very enjoyable, hilarious at times, insane at times. We burnt down, the agency burnt down on Marylebone and the High Street. I was the person who called the fire brigade, in fact. And it was during the fireman strike of that year, and I think the Green Goddesses took inordinate amount of time to arrive. So by the time the fire engines had arrived,
the agency had burnt down,
and we lost everything. So and obviously in that era, your collateral were your transparencies, were your artwork. So, but we were up and running, I think 24 hours later, in a building in Dean Street, briefly before we moved on. Actually, in Dean Street, I do remember Paul Arden, with a golf club, actually. Taking a window of glass, which landed in Dean Street. But before you briefly moved on to Covent Garden.
So I'm trying to think in that is late 70s. I'm trying to think, were there any other art directors who were creative directors? Because then writers became creative directors, not really art directors.
Yeah, and he was a completely unusual character, I think, at that time as well, because he was certainly, you could say, new wave. He offered an unpredictability and a sort of attention to creativity and artistry, which was sort of quite unusual, but bloody thrilling.
So what did you learn of Paul in those years?
Possibly...
I'm going to remind you, because I remember you once saying, I think it's something like this, off of David Holmes, you learnt to methodically go through to get to the end. And then off of Paul, it was the opposite of that. I'm trying to think whether it was just to be prepared to throw everything out the window and start again.
Or just, again, preparedness to fail, because I think, with Paul, often his ideas were ridiculously stupid. His ideas were either ridiculously stupid or so brilliant you couldn't believe the sort of the leap that he'd made. And I think there was that sort of, there was a massive, so there was obviously a preparedness to make bloody big mistakes. But he obviously had belief in himself and belief in what he did. And I think that's something that carries you a long way. The idea you can take an idea which is relatively mundane or seemingly cliched or a bit ordinary, and by sheer will, by sheer force of personality, by the power of drive, you can make it into something that's worth looking at and worth engaging with. And he was certainly, he certainly could do that. I was always marvelled at, obviously then artwork was artwork, a piece of artwork was a piece of art board on which bits of stuff were glued down with cow gum, and I can remember a number of instances where he would take one look at what he'd done, take a scalpel to it, cut it up, move the things around, and suddenly the thing that had been mundane had become extraordinary. And I always found that extraordinary, because there were the same elements. Nothing had changed, yet everything had changed.
Yeah.
So he had an ability to play and make something that was magical. And also, he was a great exponent of, he wanted you to work with the best. He wanted you to work with the best image makers, the best designers, absolutely committed to working with brilliant people.
Well, that idea that he gets your board and cuts up the... Obviously, lots of people listening to this won't know the process of PMTs waxed down or spray-mounted down. But when he was at Saatchi's, and he was known by the studio at the back that I used to use as Edward Scissorhands, because he would do exactly that. He couldn't help but turn up, pick up a pair of scissors or a knife and start cutting things up and moving things around. But one thing I remember that makes me laugh is that one night they were doing a pitch at Saatchi's and he turned up in his dressing gown at like 2 and cut some things up, moved things around. And then while they were going through the process of re-photosetting the type or whatever, there's like a few hours delay, he had a look at all the other work that was going on, some from White Collins, some from other agencies, and started cutting it all up and moving it around, you know, and changed it or re-art directed all the other work that was in the studio going through that night. So I just loved that the next day, all the different art directors from White Collins get their work back, think, God, that looks great. Really pleases themselves. Nothing like they'd briefed in, but looks really cool. Because he'd just sit there cutting everyone else's work.
I can give you 2 stories that actually give you a window into him as a man, as a character as well. For years, for quite a very long time, I did work with a writer called Rich Grisdale, he's a Stoke-on-Trent, Richard Grisdale's Stoke-on-Trent boy, but with a degree from Oxford in classics. So a sort of quite an interesting mix. Yeah. We worked at opposite ends of the buildings in Saatchi's. We weren't working together at all. I was within Paul Arden's group, the extended playpen. We were a sort of group of about 13 people that worked in a sort of detached way, not part of the main agency. You know, we were the ones that were allowed to be a bit more groovy and a bit bit freer and had a bit more flexibility on which accounts we worked on. And he'd obviously noticed, at that time I used to wear fluorescent green glasses, if I remember, and I had obviously blonde hair, blonde gelled hair, and dressed in relatively eccentric way. And at the other end of the building was Richard Grisdale, who had dyed blonde hair and also wore eccentric glasses. And I think he just thought it would be funny that the two of us were over the table together. So he merely put us together for the look of it, for a joke, to see these two people sharing the same space. But actually, you see, it worked. You know, and it was a sort of, although it was a sort of accident of identity, it actually was a very positive action. And I also remember once when he came, we were working on a beer account, 2 brewers, twice the bitter. Him coming in and sort of standing over my shoulder and looking at the work and saying, "Oh, that's brilliant! That's brilliant! It's so simple." And then he turned on his heel. "No, it's too complicated." And walked out again. He was mercurial and he saw things in black and white. He was, you never knew where you were with him. But he was joyful to be around.
It's a pretty surprising someone with those traits got to be the group director of the biggest agency in the country. Because all of those things that you say, I mean, obviously you can see all the output was amazing, but obviously to put that amount of trust and backing as they did in someone who was unpredictable, I don't know how he would, whether he was good at selling the stuff or...
Was that, I don't know. I mean, obviously I was a very, you know, I was a lowly... nothing, and then not, you know.
So did you go from LAP to Saatchi's? Did you follow
the LAP to Coleman and Partners, became Coleman and Partners, and we were on Henrietta Street in Covent Garden,
and that's where you did the Gaz.
That's where I did the Camping Gaz work
with Peter Sellers,
which was, I think, 10 commercials, which
10 radio commercials with Peter Sellers.
Yeah, if I remember rightly, we took his payment in a suitcase. It was a lot of money.
Wow, how big was that?
I think it was. I remember it as being £17,000, but I don't know. Maybe
what in cash? In no, cash.
But there was.
And how was he?
Remarkably wonderful. In some ways, disappointing because unnervingly, he'd actually learned all that. We'd sent him the scripts, and each of the scripts had two voices. And he arrived, obviously, having learnt what he needed. You know, he knew the characters, he'd invented the characters, he'd learnt the words, he'd learnt the dialogue. So actually, it was all over too quickly in a way, but it was magical and wonderful.
So that would have been around the time that he did what, Being There? I'm just trying to think. 79, yeah.
And at that time, actually, you know, he was a star. And, you know, undoubtedly, you know, people like that weren't used in advertising that much. And to actually get do a radio commercial with someone as big as that was quite a big deal. But he loved the scripts. You know, he really, and he didn't change, you know, he didn't change a word of the scripts either.
Do you have copies of those now? Or?
I've got a copy of some of them, not all of them. I think they did feature it. You know, didn't V&A did an advertising D&AD
celebration of 40 years or something? Yeah.
I think some of them were.
I wonder where we could find those.
I haven't got all of them.
So
and then I think the year after we used Terry Wogan.
Right.
Yeah, but there you go.
So then you went from Coleman's to Holmes Knight Ritchie.
Yeah.
And how did that... So at the time, that would have been very small, Holmes Knight Ritchie, very different from Coleman's.
No, after Coleman's, I became an illustrator.
Oh, okay.
I think Paul Arden was fired, if I remember rightly. I think he was fired from Coleman's, or he left anyway, and under a cloud. And I remember thinking, oh, God, nothing's going to be ever as fun in advertising as again.
Right.
And by that time, I was doing drawings.
So you quit the whole business to be an illustrator?
I quit the business to be an illustrator.
And how did that go?
Really successfully, really quick.
Did you have an agent?
I did. I was with an agent called Ian Fleming.
I remember
that.
Yeah.
And it was highly successful. I did mainly editorial work. And at that time, every illustrator on the planet wanted to work for the Radio Times. The Radio Times, you know, because obviously it was pre-internet, pre any sort of notion of if you wanted to get your work seen, then if you're an illustrator, you went for the publications that actually had the widest readership. And at that time, the Radio Times had a massive readership.
Million plus?
It sort of was like a third of the population bought the radio. You know, like the Christmas edition of the Radio Times was bought by a third, half of the population. So, and because of the regional variations in programming, they were commissioning vast numbers of illustrations on a weekly basis. So I can't think of anybody else at that time that was commissioning so much illustration of such a high caliber. And the great thing, obviously, was that as an illustrator, you were really left alone. You were given a program title, or you might be given a synopsis of a program on a Thursday night, and with a deadline of a Monday morning delivery.
So you just deliver the final thing? No roughs.
No. I might ring and say, oh, I'm thinking of drawing giving a verbal description. But that was also, there was a huge amount of freedom. But the caliber of illustration was extraordinary. And there was a great weight on one shoulder if one drew for the Radio Times, because, you know, it was...
It'd be seen.
It would be seen by, you know, not only that, but, you know, if you went back over the... Who had illustrated for the Radio Times over the, you know, since the 1920s? You know, the likes of Mervyn Peake and Eric Fraser, and extraordinary artists who were just absolutely brilliant. So it came with a...
So did you ever meet any of those guys?
Yeah, yeah. Eric Fraser was... Eric Fraser was probably the illustrator that I, at the time, admired most. His understanding of black and white and his penmanship was extraordinary. I think when I first met him, he would have been very quite old then. But we would bump into one another, picking up artworks at the end of the year. Amazing people.
So how long did you spend illustrating? How long did those years last?
Well, I did continue to illustrating for quite a long time, but obviously as I worked in other agencies, I did continue drawing as well, so I didn't actually physically completely stop. When I started working at Holmes Hunt Ritchie was an unusual agency at the time, because unlike most agencies that, you know, in that era were sort of relatively linear and single-minded in the sort of mediums that they chose or the work that they chose to work on. And Holmes Hunt Ritchie, in a way, marked the vanguard of a new style of agency. I think Yellowhammer came on a little bit later, where we would make books, we would design products, we would do drawings ourselves, we would illustrate ourselves, we would design packaging, we would do albums for bands, we would write, we would do conventional advertising as well. But there was a broader body of projects that you
and presumably that had in. Come from David. That was the sort of an appreciation for all the visual arts.
Yeah, and unusual. I mean, I think whilst I was working there, I think we were small, 3, 4, 5 art directors, but most of us were illustrators as well and artists. So we were artworking and drawing as well on our own projects. And David Holmes was a extraordinary and consummate craftsman, and I learned much from, you know, that sort of care and attention, that sort of, you know, the quality of craftsmanship was just in.
So how did that come through? What did you learn then? I spoke to David recently, and he's a very sort of infectious, positive, lovely. He just radiates. I don't know what he was like as a boss. I would imagine he was great.
He was wonderful. Not like a boss at all, really. Like a sort of and not like a dad, but certainly a sort of paternalistic and welcoming tutor, college tutor, perhaps.
So what did you pick up from him? I tell you what I really love of his stuff, that I've always loved, the Salvation Army stuff.
Amazing. Yeah.
Particularly at the time, that was so unusual looking, but so appropriate. And he still had the little rubber ink set that he'd pressed out all of the headlines with.
Well, you could say that, you know, I suppose that in that era, you know, advertising was relatively monosyllabic. You know, it had a very sort of narrow canon. You know, there would be, you know, an ad would be comprised of a photograph, a headline, and a piece of copy and a logo. But the headline would be set upper and lowercase in a bold font. You know, quite a chunky, bold period font. There were conventions to the way that settings were made, and the way that you indented copy, and the way that you set paragraphs, and the way that you displayed in the logo, and the style of the photography. And I suppose David Holmes was the first one who made communication without being so. He certainly wasn't. As dull and sort of channeled as that, he would draw on sources in a much broader, more chameleon-like way. You know, refer to different styles, to different periods, refer to different methods, using different ways of making communications and giving it a craft and a maybe that's the beginnings of where one started seeing the idea of, you referred to the Salvation Army, you know, creating a world, you know, so there isn't
a distinctive, ownable.
You know, creating distinctive, ownable worlds.
I mean, he looked like he didn't give a shit about Bill Birnbach and anything they'd done. He just did whatever he wanted to do. Do you know what I mean? Lots of people copy whatever the trend is of the day. And particularly when you look through his work, it looks like it's triggered by what he wants to do, not what other people are doing.
Certainly
nobody, when he did Salvation Army, was doing, I can find anyway, anything remotely using such battered, terrible type, you know.
And clever, you know, in a way, you know, when one of the, I always marvelled at the, one of the pieces of work that I think is, wasn't for me, was the most memorable, was there was the Macallan, the whiskey account, which was a sort of, you know, account with no money to speak of. And he had the clever idea of actually thinking, you know, the Macallan's quite a, you know, of actually placing small space ads next door to the crossword, but on a daily basis. So the turnaround of work was enormous, hundreds and hundreds of ads where he was, he and the writer called Nick Salomon were writing and drawing.
Almost daily.
So clever and interesting in terms of creating a space for a brand like that to exist.
And it's funny now when I think of them, they're almost like sending out a tweet every day, aren't they? Do you know what I mean? They're not like and they're not like ads. No. They're like, it's a couple of thoughts on spam. I can't remember what that had to do with, but it feels like just a dialogue with someone, almost like a daily tweet.
Well, it's an intelligent, rather than a conversation.
What's our USP? Which obviously ultimately builds up a stronger bond, because it's not like you're trying to beat people over the head with your boring message about twice distilled in oak barrels or whatever the thing is.
But unusually, weirdly, I mean, can you imagine this now? As an agency, we had two malt whiskey accounts.
Yeah, why was that?
You know, so David worked on the Macallan and I had Glenmorangie. But they were both... you have to imagine an era when the idea of both clients, I think, didn't see themselves as rivals because they were different.
Just very, so different, yeah.
They weren't linked in any way at all.
How bizarre.
But, you know, I think they felt distinct enough and strong enough in their own skins to not feel that...
They did appeal to different people, I guess.
So
was that the first time there that you did the Glenmorangie stuff?
Yeah.
And that was it? So
That was, yeah.
The 16 Men of Tain.
Yeah, there was that handcrafted, although it's not, it's the vestige of that is still, you know, it was handcrafted by the 16 Men of Tain. I think it's now... The line still exists, although it's been...
Three Men of Tain.
It's perfected by the 16 Men of Tain.
Perfected by... Okay, what does that mean? They press the buttons and...
Well, you know, it's a slightly more...
Give it a stir at the end.
Yeah.
But again, I love that set. That was so... I suppose that's the sort of work that, again... In an era when everything was about USPs and logic, and that just felt authentic and different, and
which was the purpose in a way, because I think, you know, if you look at the Glenmorangie bottle now, it has a certain naivety, and that it was all born out of that. The bottle has a naivety and a sort of undesignedness to it. It feels, it has a real authenticity. It has a sort of strange brown-coloured label and a rather archaic sort of naive piece of typography and framing.
So is that how you started that campaign? Because I suppose
I was thinking, you know, it came just out of, you know, what if you could imagine, what would the 16 men, what would they do? What would the 16 men obtain? What would those...
If they were doing their own ads,
what would they look like? So I didn't want to do ads. I didn't want to do ads which had a headline or had all of the conventions.
Saying clever stuff.
Although ultimately, I mean, they had a bloody big logos because actually the branding, their sort of their anti... they are, yeah, they have a sort of, yeah, they're very much against, they were very much against the way that ads and conventions of the time worked. And in order to illustrate that, I wanted to use a, I think, or maybe at the time, maybe I was just into wood engravings anyway. Or at that time, I'd started looking at books by wood engravers, by, you know, the likes of Claire Leighton and Eric Gill and others, Agnes Miller Parker and all sorts of people, Gertrude Hermy, all that lot. And I thought it'd be great to find, you know, if one was to not have photographs but actually illustrate using wood engravings. There weren't any around at the time. It was a sort of dead art in a way. It had obviously been something that had been extraordinarily important in British art in the 20s, 30s, 40s, but by the 70s it was definitely,
well, it seemed as just old fashionable, wasn't it?
It was completely so it was unfashionable. And
completely photography was the thing.
So it was actually very hard trying to find somebody who actually still, who was a wood engraver. I think I went to the Society of Painters, Etchers and Wood Engravers and they gave me a few names, and amongst them was a guy called George Tute, FSIA.
Yeah.
And he certainly had never come into contact with an advertising agency before, so he.
And what would he have been doing? What would he have been engraving
just
for?
Books.
Just
engraving books. But obviously, it was, you know, that gave Glenn Morangy a real strong personality, and I had a lot of giggles and chuckles after the event. The client, a guy called Neil Macero. I think it took 6 months to persuade him that it was a good idea.
What was the sticking point with that?
Well, because they all thought it was terribly old-fashioned. And
right. They wanted to be
archaic,
cool and
to be cool, yeah.
Have hit people in their head.
But it was massively successful. You know, it absolutely became to define the brand and actually made it you know, a major malt whiskey. You know, it was a real success.
Was it tiny, presumably, at the time when you took it?
Yeah. So... but a very lovely man, the client, Nick, you know, very very appreciative after the event. Yeah.
So what things did you work on in that first stint at Homes Like Ritchie?
Well, a variety of accounts. We did a lot of work for Polygram, Polydor. We launched the CD, in fact.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Did posters for The Who. Yeah.
What, The Who bands. Launching the CD or just The Who for concerts or albums?
No,
or?
Albums, yeah. So we did sort of quite a bit of... Yeah,
did you do any album covers?
No album covers at that time. It was just really publicity material and posters and press ads for bands. Tfal, kitchenware.
So after that, so why leave? That sounds like the sort of perfect little home. And you went from there to join Paul Arden again at Saatchi's.
Well, by that time he had gone to Saatchi's, and Saatchi's was, you know, Saatchi's was the biggest agency in the world, the most creative agency in the world. What a draw. And I thought,
what year was this then? Sort of 84, 5, maybe?
It was certainly in, it was in the heyday. It was the era of the great British Airways films. So it would have been, you know, it was...
So they were the all-conquering, we got Maggie into power, turned around BA...
Exactly.
Bought up all the agencies around the world. They sort
exactly.
of, what is it? Nothing is impossible.
Yeah, and I
and Paul reached out to you.
Yeah, and I think he maybe, I think he created the Playpen, which was a group of sort of younger art directors and writers in the agency, and he was. I think maybe I thought maybe he was just looking for people who didn't come from a sort of archetypal background, who weren't just, you know, who were a little bit more diverse. My first day in the agency was amusing. He had a big corner office with a great big chrome and glass desk. Very well, a very lovely office. He was wearing his suits by then. He wore, you know, his broad pinstripe suits. He was a man of, it was a man at ease in his environment. He'd shot Silk Cut by then, although it hadn't gone out as a campaign. And I think the first day I arrived was the last. He was about to go on holiday, and he left me in this office for 2 weeks because I hadn't been yet given
an office. In his room.
In his room, and this was an era when if you were Paul Arden at Saatchi's, what you got was a silver tray in the morning. You got a silver jug of coffee. You got biscuits that were wrapped in silver paper on a plate. You know, and there's obviously, each strata within the organisation, there must have been sort of codes of arrival, and one of those was the coffee. And I remember for the first two or three days, this coffee jug arrived for me.
So you got the whole service, the silver coffee jug, the wrapped biscuits.
I think they knew who I was, sitting in Paul Arden's room.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the silver jug lasted for two or three days. It sort of quickly disappeared, but I did get the silver jug for a little while. But what he'd left on his desk was he'd left a huge stack of 10/8 transparencies, and they were all Silk Cut. They were all versions.
What, the first version of just the one the silk, cut yeah. piece of silk? Graham Ford, was that?
Graham Ford, amongst others.
Really?
And because, you know, obviously Paul had dyed fabric in them in all sorts of different ways, used all different sorts of fabric, had cut silk in all sorts of different ways. So the idea of...
God, who were the photographers? Do you remember who we used? I know Graham was...
Else. It might have been Ed White.
Right.
Might have been a few others, I can't remember. But the stack of the 10/8s on the desk was about 2 foot high.
God, amazing.
And he said, "Come when I come back, I want to see a cropped one. I want to know what it looks like as a crop." So that was the first 2 weeks.
2 weeks
of my time at Saatchi's, we're cropping, trying to, you know.
And how did you do?
I think okay.
Did he come back and like it, or what did you do, well, or did you pick?
He must have done because I was given the job. Or I was with tragedy. This never came off. I was given the job of making the first Silk Cut film, and it got very serious to a point where we had a director, and it was Brian Duffy was the nominated, and Duffy actually became a really good friend over that period. He introduced me to mozzarella cheese and all other and many
exotic
other
world of mozzarella worlds. Cheese.
Yeah, he had a studio. Duffy had a studio in King Henry's Road in Primrose Hill, and I'd go and spend hours with him, drawing up storyboards and coming up with ideas. I still have the story, which I haven't shown you actually, and I know it's somewhere at home. I've got
the Silk Cut storyboard.
I've got a book somewhere. I've got the entire. Yeah, I've got the story. The Silk Cut. Storyboard of the film that was never made, and hundreds of Silk Cut ideas, all watercolours, little watercolours of
get those in
ideas.
And you would do those with Duffy.
And I did that, yeah. We'd sit on his trestle table in the garden outside.
That's the garden where he set light to all his negatives, supposedly.
Yeah.
So how did Paul? So what happened when he came back then? So was that nerve wracking when your two weeks of
nightmare?
One job, cropping a picture.
Yeah. It's all right. We moved on. And then, as I said, he found me a writer. He quickly found me a writer from, you know, Richard.
So what else did you work on when you were there at Saatchi's?
Red Star. Red Star? Alexon. Yeah. There was a fashion account which...
So these are all the... accounts that he would have been close to, that he worked on himself. Yeah,
yeah. And obviously, already by then on Alexon, he'd shot with Richard Avedon, with David Bailey, with Terry Donovan, with Norman Parkinson, with Barry, with
Barney Edwards.
Barney Edwards with whole Horst. Like horse shot one as well.
Today, I don't remember that. Is.
So I caught the tail end of that. So I did a couple of shoots. I did one shoot with a couple of shoots with Norman Parkinson. There was one shoot with Henri Lartigue that could have happened.
Oh wow!
Who died very soon afterwards
for Alexon.
For Alexon, yeah, that didn't happen.
Did you get
and
to meet him?
And the shoot with. Oh God, who is that dreadful woman? Barbara Cartland.
Oh, right. What, for Alexon? You're going to do Barbara
Ironic.
Cartland?
Ironic. Yeah.
So Sarches at that time then must have been, I mean, it sounds like another planet where you could get half a dozen photographers to shoot bits of silk that were all dyed different colours and then just go, we'll have that one. Because at the time, he was seen as a maniac because he would order up 5 different fonts rather than picking one, which most people thought, it's so extravagant. Why don't you just pick the one you want to use then try all these endless fonts? But going to lots of photographers to shoot the things, I mean, there must have been a wash with money.
Yeah.
It must have been very glamorous at the time, Sartre.
Massively. And I think, I don't know all the stories behind the Alexon, the Avedon shoot, but I think it was brilliant, but and cataclysmic. I think at the same time, obviously it was Tim Mellors wrote the copy. Great copy.
Yeah.
From what I remember, I don't know that he had client sign off on that shoot. I don't know
on the Avedon shoot.
Yeah, I don't know. Really? I don't know that he had budget sign off on the shoot. But he certainly, and in those days, you really didn't often go to New York to shoot with Richard Avedon. Even then, that was sort of quite, that was a monumental leap, really. And actually, in the end, sort of Alexon was quite a formal sort of British brand, a sort of
The rumour was it didn't help them at all. I can't imagine how much they would have spent on photography alone, let alone media for a company that size. Yeah. But
well, I think it's hilarious in a way. You think what one ended up with was a portrait of Iman, not wearing the dress, but with
probably wouldn't have been allowed in the shop.
No, but not only not wearing the dress, but actually, with the dress wound round her head like
tied round her head, bold.
And so, but I, the last vestiges of I suppose an agency having a vision and giving a client what they think the client should have.
Did you like it there? I mean, partly on the one hand, it's an immense playground. You've got endless cash to spend on photographers and the best people and multiple best people for certain projects. On the other hand, I would imagine it's a very hard-nosed, testosterone-y, wide boyish. So, do you know what I mean? I don't know.
And culturally.
I would imagine, I didn't enjoy on one hand, it's not your thing.
Yeah,
but
culturally, I didn't enjoy it because I think that, Paul, although I loved him, I think the idea of working through chaos is not how I work.
Not long-term.
And I think actually, if you
had he changed,
Did he change?
Was he a different guy then at Sarches than he was at LL?
Not really. LL. But then maybe that by that time I'd worked out what style of work I wanted to do, and I think what I liked was not what necessarily, I like working in a sort of not slow, but I like working with a deliberate and crafted.
Yeah. Not random.
Not random. And I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah. So you went back to Holmes Not Richie?
So I went back to Holmes Not Richie. Yeah.
So at this point, were they in the Muse? So they'd grown a bit?
They'd moved to Broad, just behind DDB, Doyle Dane Burnback, just behind Baker Street, in an old tyre brake factory building, Muse. Where I got my first company car.
Which
was a Lancia, a supercharged Lancia Volume X, which was way too powerful for somebody who was new to driving. I remember Alistair Ritchie, who was the managing director, was disappointed because he wanted me to get a classic car, and he had suggested that I get a Jaguar XK120.
Right. He was disappointed you didn't take up his suggestion.
Yeah, his suggestion. Which, in retrospect, he actually probably would have been a good idea had I kept it, because it would be worth a hell of a lot of money now, seeing how the price of classic cars has just...
So what was that like going back then? They, obviously, people say don't go back.
But I was welcomed back, and it was because it was a much gentler and much more
appropriate
culture. And I was still drawing and doing all sorts of other things as well. And I think I can remember. Actually, it's the only agency maybe that I brought in things from home. So. My favourite things from home. I had a couple of sculptures in the corner.
So it felt like home.
It felt like home.
Yeah.
And actually, I used to, if I wasn't working or if it was a bit, if we were down, not that busy, I'd do my own drawings. And I think I even had a glass table there where I did monoprints and printed
within the agency.
Within the agency.
Amazing.
Yeah. So it was much more. It was just very human and very. We worked hard, we got on with one another, we loved one another, we were all, you know, it was...
And they started to do very well at that point, didn't they? They always seemed like...
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting in retrospect, looking at their work, when I spoke to David, that it's very diverse, and a lot of it stands up quite well, I guess, because it wasn't totally about what was the trend that week.
Yeah.
It was people doing their own thing, I think. Yeah. Probably because he was... Perhaps gentler and not everything being his vision.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, you know, certain work that, you know, like the Grolsch work that you did still stands up really well. A lot of it stands up really well, I think.
Yeah, well, maybe because it wasn't driven by the conventions that most agencies were. It was more, to call it artistic probably is the wrong thing, but it was just not so... It wasn't full of the same conventions.
No, I mean, it's always interesting when you look at what was doing very well at the time, and you look at Sainsbury's and whatever it may be, they date really badly. And certain things like Glenmorangie and Grolsch, and I still think the Nikon, which I know you're so-so on, stand up well.
But is that because we were doing other things as well, like designing books?
I think it probably is. You were probably bringing in more reference points and not... Following the trend, you were doing...
Because we were, you know...
You're probably an outsider in the business. You weren't one of the number of agencies that all competed. It felt like you just were over there doing your own thing.
Yeah.
But obviously started to do well, started to grow.
Yeah.
And who did you work with there at Homes Like Richie?
My writer was a guy called Anthony Horowitz, who now... He's a legendary author, boys, children's author. Boys,
the James Bond book.
The James Bond books, Sherlock Holmes, Midsummer Murders, Foyle's War.
He's done all of those.
Name
wow.
It. Tintin, Steven Spielberg. You know, he's
what
like,
did you
he's
do with him?
Machine.
What were you doing with him?
Well,
that was him. Okay.
Yeah. And he used to go home. He was a magician as well. First time I met him, he's he was a member of the Magic Circle. I think almost the first time I met him, he took a cigarette and
from his
and
ear.
Stubbed it out on my fabulously new River Island jacket, which I was so proud of, and I was dismayed. And it was he was very good at he was really good at sleight of hand, although his hand shook a lot. He was very good at close magic. Yeah, and he'd go home and write every night. So he had
TV or film or plays.
At that time, he'd already done TV. He'd already done Robin of Sherwood. You know, I think that
with Jason Connery.
Jason Connery.
Right.
So he, you know.
So was it this time or Sarches? I'm thinking now when we're talking, it was probably Sarches. It would make sense that the Les Blair, the director and writer, trailed you around to see how creative teams worked.
No,
Honest, Decent and True. Was that at Holmes Night, Richie?
Yeah, it was Holmes Night, Richie. But no, what happened was we had an art buyer called Sue Bryson, who came from Zimbabwe, which is where
Richard E. Grant
hails.
So Richard E., I'm guessing, and he was of the people, he was you.
Yeah.
Richard E. Grant with the weird haircut, funny glasses.
He was
based on you.
And he had, so Sue Bryson had a young actor friend who was looking for his first, he was looking for his first role, first major role, and he needed to become an art director. So I took him on this nameless actor under my wing for a few weeks to school him in the ways of an art director, thinking that he would, and actually he actually got that role in the Les Blair film, but what I didn't realise at the time that he was going to pillage my personality so completely. And so when I first saw the film, not only had he got the role and was playing an art director, but he was sporting the same piece of jewellery around the neck that I used to wear. I used to wear, at that time, I wore kimonos. I had gelled hair, handmade glasses, and carried little sketchbooks around with circles in them. And had I took him for a Japanese meal as well. And so, I mean, all of...
So he would literally follow you around for a few weeks?
For a couple of weeks. Just to get to be able to...
The research? Was he nice?
Yeah, it was lovely, and he had startling blue eyes, and you thought, oh yeah, no, you're going to be, I knew that he was.
And this is obviously pre With Nail and I.
Yeah, yeah, and it was obviously, and pre How to Get Ahead in Advertising. So it was, but it was, the, I think it was his, so it was his first film, really.
So were you offended when you saw the final result?
No, how could I be? It was amusing and charming.
So I'll have to attach this to the blog post. People can watch that and make their mind up.
It's very funny, though, because it is like looking at... there's a certain, because I have got very few photographs of... if you wanted to stand out in that at that time, buying clothes was actually hard work.
So you'd wear kimonos?
Yeah.
You said, yeah, like... pair of jeans. Yeah, of course I'd wear kimonos.
Well, if you wanted, but, because if you wanted to buy a piece of clothing that was interesting, there were no brands as such, and there were Gentlemen's Outfitters, and not a lot else.
Really? We're talking 1985. You've been making it sound like 1922.
Well, it was still relatively.
Were they not
on the ground? If you wanted really good.
Where would you get your kimonos then?
From Flip on Longacre.
I remember that, yeah.
And they were one of the first shops, I suppose, like Lawrence Corner and Flip, but from Flip they obviously brought in American retro clothes, bomber jackets and tuxedo. For a long time I wore a sort of beautiful blue brocade tuxedo that I'd got there as well. But kimonos, beautiful silk kimonos. I mean, they're amazing things that cost nothing.
So where did that style come from? The kimono. What do you wear with a kimono?
You think of it. It's period glam.
Is it sort of?
It's, well, think of all of the bands that are around. Everybody from
Duran Duran, Spandau. Spandau. So you sort of influenced by that set, Japan.
Yeah, and also because I'd been just before that, I'd been doing. I did spend a time making props and bits because my wife at the time was a costume designer making her way at the BBC, so we often worked together, or she gave me projects to do, so I then finding interesting clothes. I had a wonderful shirt made by English Eccentrics that I I long for now. So
is that where you'd make props? You also had a spell making props for the BBC.
Yeah, no. I used to make things for or productions that Odile was working on. So, spears, helmets, poison bottles, all manner of things for Doctor Who. I didn't keep the prop. I used to have loads of. I burnt them. I think like Duffy.
You did a Duffy and burnt Duffy all your oversized medicine bottles and spears in the garden.
And then things like.
So you could watch an old Doctor Who, or what was the other one you said? Q7 or 8.
Spike Milligan, yeah.
So you can see those old programs and see your oversized medicine bottles and stuff.
And my oversized Victoria.
How did you get that? It seems like you didn't have qualifications for all these things. You'd turn up and say, "I can do that."
Well, I think you think about, you know, BBC was not funded. Your film wasn't funded in the way that.
So the lack of money meant they'd give people a chance.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and you know, through my wife, and then and Doctor Who, Doctor Who was a children's program, so you know everything was made out of squeezy bottles, and and there wasn't that sort of attention to CGI and effects or special effects that there obviously is now. It was much more. It was if you look back at those episodes, they're pretty
wobbly walls and stuff,
pretty hokey, but you know. Fun and charming for it,
So then you go back to Sarches. It's getting confusing now. You go to Holmes Night Ritchie, then Sarches, then Holmes Night Ritchie, and then you went back to Sarches again.
Briefly, I don't know. Why did I go back? I don't know.
Cash, hard cash.
Yeah, weirdly, I mean, unfortunately, I've never been driven by money in this profession, and that's my great downfall, because by rights, I should have my little house in Little Venice and et cetera, et cetera. But it was always about the work, about trying to do interesting and good things. So I went back, and I think... God, did we run the playpen for a bit? Yeah. I went back with Richard Christie. I think we ran the playpen for a bit. And I gave the Thunder Jockeys a job there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I've forgotten that.
And what would that entail?
I think I got into trouble there because they stripped one of the rooms. I mean, you know.
One of the meeting rooms?
I don't know if any of you probably, you know, I don't know if you... Do you remember the Thunder Jockeys?
Yeah, I remember that. They did a European illustration annual. I remember that was lovely. Yeah,
no, they're insane, and they turned a room into a vision of their own world, which I think the folk who look after the house,
Silver Teapot Lock, probably didn't go down very well. Yeah. So what would that mean then when you were looking after the playpen? Would that mean you had certain accounts that would get thrown to the playpen, or
no, it was just, how would that? Just looking after the younger, you know, the sort of the placement teams, looking after the younger.
And what would you have been working on? What sort of bits of business?
Oh, Matt, again, British Airways again at that time, and Visa. There's a film that you haven't found. It was I did a film with Matt Forrest.
I remember
that's Matt. Another crazy film.
Is it another one of your Spike Milligan type?
Visa shot in Barcelona.
Right.
That's quite surreal and odd.
As I'll try and find it.
The other films that you've had.
And what about British Airways? What did you do on British Airways? Anything I would have seen or?
There was one campaign that I really, really liked that. Was it Barry Latigan shot in the end? I did the launch campaign. That's a piece of work that has gone completely. I did the launch campaign for One World Alliance. You know, so it was a great big piece about bringing the world together.
Right.
And the campaign, they were quite, in a way, they were quite classic ads, a sort of manifesto of togetherness, typographic manifesto of togetherness on one side, and then on the other side was a portrait of two people from different places in the world. So let's say, I can't hardly remember, like a dancer from Sri Lanka standing next to a dancer from the Kirov Ballet.
I don't think I've ever seen those.
A Scottish clan chief standing next to an American fire chief. So people with this, yeah, you know, sort of the juxtaposition.
Yeah. Similar, I don't think I've ever seen those. They ran in this country, did they?
They did, yeah. Conceptually, I still really like it. And it's a really simple exposition of the idea. And obviously, with a lot of those people, they haven't. It became a PR event in itself, yeah, you know, what we were doing.
Now it'd be for the shoot, exploited and used, yeah, a lot.
Bringing all those individuals, yeah, together for that moment, for the shoot.
So you used real people rather than dress people up as,
yeah,
a fireman.
Yeah. So the work was still interesting.
So why did you leave the second time? How long did you stay?
I left the second time because it felt like something badly was going wrong. And obviously, I think weeks after I left, the agencies split.
Oh, right. So it was just before the split before when they kicked out, yeah, Charles Saatchi and, yeah, ultimately all the M&C Saatchi lot. Shame. There's a lot of good people there at the time. Jeremy Sinclair. Did you work with Jeremy?
Jeremy Sinclair.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so he referred to me.
Oh, he was the one who, yeah,
referred to me as the designer, yeah, chappy. You know.
So,
and do I remember? I'm sure I remember that actually. That, you know, because he was the creative director of all creative directors, wasn't he? And I'm sure he used to have an intercom system. And I can't imagine this, but if he wanted to talk to an account director, there was a button in his desk. Yeah, didn't pick up the phone. There was a, are you there?
And that, you would know, go to who?
It would go to the account directors.
What, you'd have a whole board of?
I think so. I'm sure I can't have invented that.
That sounds,
I can't have imagined that.
Like,
you know, like a tannoy system.
He's quite sort of grand, isn't he?
Yeah.
I've interviewed him, went to the Sorbonne. Yeah, it's possible. So where did you go? Why did you leave and where did you go? It just felt like it was unravelling.
It felt like the whole thing was unravelling, and an unpleasant feeling. So off I went again. This time...
You didn't go back to HSH, Homes Like Richie, for the third time?
No, did I next
DDB.
Did I go to DDB or did I go
think
to
you did.
Legashef?
No, no, you went to DDB.
I went to DDB.
So how did that come about? Obviously, Tony, I would imagine, is more in the sort of David Holmes vibe than the Paul Arden or one of those.
I was right on the brink. I think I was Tony's first hiring.
Were you in London?
Yeah. Because who's the creative director before him?
Dawson Yeoman.
Dawson Yeoman. So I had Dawson Yeoman's wooden blinds in my office, in fact. So I'm sure I was Tony's first hiring. And he was quite, you know, that was quite interesting at the time because he'd come down from Halls in Scotland.
Yeah.
He wasn't an obvious choice.
Ex-professor or something, wasn't he?
He's the teacher of English, I think, at Edinburgh University. Or he was a... what a heavenly man.
Yeah.
Really. And in some ways, I think it's not surprising that he's been forgotten, because I don't think he was, as a character, it was never about him. I don't know whether you have the same. But I always say, you know,
it's difficult to spot his ego, really. I mean, I worked with him at two places, and he was. I mean, it's interesting when I was at BNP with him, when you were there, it was difficult to see what he did, and then the minute he went, it fell apart.
But I think that's the strength. That was the. the power and the way that he behaved. And I think it was he had the smallest office in the creative department.
Yeah,
it was a humble office with nothing in it other than a desk and a chair, and he was never in it. And generally, if you wanted to find him, he was probably with the creative more often than not. He was really good at hiring, though. I mean, he hired extraordinary talent. And that time that when we worked together, you know, there was obviously Andy McLeod and Richard Flint. And
yeah.
There was...
there's tons of... I mean, it's a great department.
Kim and Tony. Yeah. Kim and Tony. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And I never felt that he ever told me what to do. But I always felt that he was always there for me if I wanted him.
Mm.
Not only with my work, but with my private life as well. So it felt like he was... he looked after his department, I think, in a very quiet... Unshowy way.
So when you went to DDB, was that to work with him? Because you did lots of work together, wasn't it? Were you his sort of
when I could persuade him to, because he didn't write that often, and when I could persuade him to, yeah, we did some really nice work together. Yeah, lovely. We once went to Los Angeles for dinner. Yeah, that was quite funny.
What do you mean you went to Los Angeles for dinner? What does that mean? What, on a shoot or?
No, I think we'd won Agency of the Year. Was it the Big American? It was Advent. Big American Advertising?
Adweek.
Was it Adweek? Yeah. We'd won International Advertising Agency of the Year, and he said, "Oh, should we go and pick up this award?"
Nice.
We flew to LA for dinner in the Beverly Hills Hotel. All I remember about that was I was the only one wearing a kimono in.
They didn't have a flip over there.
in a very serious room.
Do you wear how does kimonos work? Do you wear trousers with kimono? I don't know what.
Yeah, and I had a pair of trousers.
What is the kimonos?
Full length, open and flowing with a big white silk shirt and a jewel at my neck.
So no trousers underneath.
Yeah, yeah,
trousers underneath. Yeah. I don't really know how they work, kimonos. Yeah.
I think I sat at the same table as Michael J. Eisner, who was the CEO of Disney.
Not in a kimono.
Not in a kimono. Yeah. God in heaven. Yeah. And then back. And back 24 hours later.
So it's interesting for me that at DDB, you sort of refined the Volkswagen house style, which was the sort of sacred look. And you respaced out the type, made it more...
It got a bit lazy.
...elegant.
Yeah, I hadn't got...
And changed it, which I would imagine people would have resisted.
They did, yeah. And there were a few teams there that hated it, were really offended. And
that you changed it?
Yeah.
Some of the creative teams were offended that you wanted to change...
And mainly because I think if you look back at the early Volkswagen ads... There's a brevity and a clarity and a sort of quite spare,
yeah,
typographically and in terms of image making, and I think it had got a bit clumpy as maybe the fonts started getting used,
started getting bigger and
chunkier and a bit sort of not sloppy but just not refined in the way that the early metal set ads were, and I always felt that I wanted to sort of try and gain, and also I think it had lost the wit as well. If you look back at the early Beatle ads, they are surreal and hilarious. And I wanted to.
Yeah, they've got a bit basic and bloody, haven't they, through the 70s and early 80s.
So I think it was trying to find something else or find a different other tools to actually come back to the same similar principles. So by sort of refining the type a bit and spacing it a little bit, giving it a bit more air by introducing a sort of humour in the image making, by introducing people as well. Mm. So the people that I was casting, well, they weren't everyday people.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah, it got a bit meat and potatoes. I can't really think of what the clumpy meat and potatoes. There's something about when you look at that stuff that was being done that was, it took it into a more refined, sophisticated world.
But like you, though, I mean, I started using, you know, I struck up company with Malcolm Benville, more or less. I mean, probably not at the same time. And I got interested in, you know, how do you make it, you know, how do you take something which is quite ordinary and make it extraordinary? And I started doing things like, it might sound ridiculous, but getting the model to wear a pair of shoes that were two sizes too big.
Yeah.
Or a pair of trousers that were the wrong, or a jacket that was the wrong fit, or a pair of trousers that were too short.
It's interesting, that detail.
Prosthetics on, or making a nose. Things that are sort of quite... not immediate, but give an image a sort of... a jolt and a sort of surprise and a sort of...
Well, there's a funny... One of the best examples I know of that is, funny enough, from Paul Arden, and it's this ad that I've always thought, God, there's something really odd about that shot. It's sort of just a picture of a kid, little kid, who's just been promoted, right? And I've been aware of this ad for like 20 years and just thought it was good. And then when I interviewed Jeff Stark, he said, oh, that's my son in the ad. It says something like, he got promoted. Do you know that ad? He said, and Paul made him put his glasses on upside down.
I'm doing it now.
So it's literally like that. You don't notice them as upside down. Yeah. You just think, it's just something weird about the shot. Some quirky little thing that you almost don't take in. I never noticed it. It's obvious when you see now, but he just made him put his glasses on upside down. And I think, it's funny, I've got a little art direction quiz for you based on details. So, let's see. So here's a quote, and I've remembered some of these. Shows the sort of rubbish that I keep around in my head. But we tried to dull down the reflection on the man's face to match the bronze statues. Which ad is that? See if you instantly remember. You've said this.
Well, that would be a Tate Gallery.
That's Tate Gallery. So
with Andreas.
The reflection. So it's an interesting little detail. So within the shot, I suppose I'm always struck now, people don't seem to think things through. So within the shot, the reflection of the skin tone, or the reflection of the man in the ad, and I looked at it this afternoon when we were, was dulled down or something to be in line with the bronze statue. You're saying it like, well, why would you not do that?
Yeah,
but it's an interesting little thing. So you got that one. You're one out of one so far. I shot the children looking through the camera, past it, to try and capture that vacant state of mind, however you describe it.
Bernardo. But again, beginning that's a sort of, there was a deliberate, you know, that was a campaign of portraits, and, you know, and traditionally you'd say that what is a portrait? A portrait is an image. The traditional image of a portrait is a picture of a person recorded by a photographer, and generally what you do is you get the sitter to look at the photographer, and in that way you get it's about communication, it's about joining up, it's about having a relationship. And since this was Bernardo's, and Bernardo's looks after kids that are disconnected, about kids that are troubled, about, you know, kids that actually are bad kids, you could say. I wanted to try and make portraiture that in one way was confrontational and about a simple portrait, but at the same time I wanted there to be an unnerving disconnection that was maybe not immediately obvious. To give you a, to just give the images a sort of a bite or something that you weren't that surprised you. And so we got the kids to, the brief to the kids was to look through the photographer, to not look at the photographer, but to look through them, so that there's a sort of connection, but you know there's something mm. not quite right. But it's not immediately obvious what that thing is. But all of that is pre-designed,
But it's the predetermined bit that I think is amazing, because barely anyone, they'd say, oh, we're going to have a picture of a kid. We'll cast someone who's whatever, a bit of a troublemaker, have had some issues, and then they'll pick someone with, you know, a funny nose or whatever it may be. But to think about the vibe they're giving off is quite unusual. And I think, so I wouldn't have known, I know that those portraits are slightly haunting. There's something about them, and I wouldn't have known that they're looking through the camera, however you've approached it. But I do know that they're not like ad portraits, and there's something slightly haunting about them. And that makes them emotional, and that makes you engage with the thing more. Mm. And I don't know many people who would plot that out. You know, most people look at it on a very basic terms. We're going to say this, we want a kid.
And but again, it comes down to it's,
but the value of it is enormous, because it makes it resonate and makes it work.
And for me the most important dialogue, the most important conversation is some that is not happening at the moment, and it's the thing that fascinates me and that I talk about most is feeling, if you like. When you first approach an idea, and that's why I think it's never been more important for an art director. The art director is absolutely crucial. At the, you know, I think I said before.